Welcome to the Church Times podcast. Try 10 issues for £10 or 2 months access to our website and apps also for £10. Go to churchtimes.co.uk/new-reader.
Hello, this is Sarah Merrick with the Church Times Books podcast, and I'm in conversation today with Emily Rhodes about The Beginning of Spring by Penelope Fitzgerald. It was published in 1988, and it's the book we've chosen as this month's book club title. Emily, welcome. Could we start, please, by you just telling us something about the novel?
Yes, of course. Hello, Sarah. It's so nice to be back here. Thanks for having me on. So, The Beginning of Spring by Penelope Fitzgerald is set at the beginning of spring, but in 1913 in Moscow. And she completely captures the feeling of this very foreign other place as the seasons are changing. She says things like very precise details, such as there are 140 days a year of frost, and statues in the garden are wrapped in straw against the cold. So even though, like me, you might never have been to Moscow, you can completely imagine what it's like. And just as spring is coming to Moscow, Frank Reed's wife, Nellie, has left him, and she's left Moscow, and she's gone on a train back to England, we assume, with their three children. Luckily, the children are deposited at a railway station very soon after, and he goes and collects them. But there's this kind of mystery of, you know, where has Nellie gone? To sort of fulfill a childcare gap, Frank is encouraged by one of his employees, a rather wonderful figure called Selwyn, to employ a nanny called Lisa Ivanova. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. And of course, with Nellie gone, Frank soon finds himself falling for Lisa. So that is kind of the plot, but it is so not really about the plot, this book, I would say.
You talk in your piece about the sort of extraordinary little vignettes in the book. I mean, there's one famous one. Give us a couple of examples. Give us a flavour of the sort of sudden.
Okay. So reading this, you instantly become an expert in like printing presses and monotype and linotype and the real mechanics in how, you know, the uppercase literally being a case, not just capital letters, the real mechanics of what it's like to be in a printing press. There's also a brilliant moment with a bear, which becomes rather shocking. He sort of downs all the vodka and then there's a fire. There is an incredibly eerie moment towards the end, which I think we can talk about. I don't think it's a spoiler. It's so Russian. You know, there's the bear. There's lots of talk about samovars, and there's a dacha, this kind of country house where the children want to go. And they go with the nanny, and there's this strange, incredibly eerie night walk through the birch trees. I'll just read, there's like a line. You just don't know what you're going to see. You don't know what to expect. There's these birch trees. You're sort of deep in Russia. And then suddenly, among the thronging stems of the birch trees were what looked like human hands moving to touch each other across the whiteness and blackness. It's so strange. And the person who is witnessing this is this child. She doesn't really know what's going on. And it's quite unnerving as a reader to kind of share that child's perspective. You also don't know what's going on. Normally in these situations, you're like, oh yes, you know, the child thinks this is happening, but actually as adults, we're aware of the full picture, but we don't really know. And I think that's one of the great things about this book. She takes you to this beautifully realized Russia, to Moscow 1913, with the samovars and the printing press and the rest of it. But she also really wrong-foots you. And just when you think you've kind of got the picture of what's going on, actually, it's all slightly off and uncertain and unknowable, really, quite uncanny.
I think there's a sort of enchantment about it, isn't there? It's, you know, the sort of mystery and the magic. And yet, I don't quite understand why it is so charming and beguiling. It's just the sort of thing I might find irritating, I think, in less assured hands.
You're right. I mean, I think for me, one of the reasons why it's not irritating is because it's also really funny. You know, her characters are so good. They're so well drawn, these real misfits. And I think this is true in, I think, all her books that I've read. They're always these eccentric characters who she kind of loves and is very affectionate towards, and they're these very endearing portraits, but also while kind of laughing at their eccentricities a little bit. So we can't it can't be too sort of twee and sort of too enchanting. It's not too annoying, I think, because she helps us to laugh with her.
Yes, and so it becomes a sort of very observational as well, doesn't it? That life is extraordinary, if perhaps not necessarily quite like this. I'd like to come on to the characters in a minute, but just thinking about the sort of public reception of this book. I mean, she's a very interesting novelist. She didn't start writing her novels until slightly later in life. I mean, she had a, and in many ways, a sort of what sounds like a quite a sad story. She was
Yeah,
from
quite a
very
terrible life.
Yes, she was from a very distinguished background with some very, very kind of illustrious, family members and so on. And she goes to university and gets, a top first. She's obviously brilliant. And then marries a man who comes home from the war an alcoholic and, loses his job. And it all sounds financially incredibly perilous. So there's a sort of sadness there. But later in life, it's almost as if, I mean, I'm obviously just speculating, she sort of collects together all these extraordinary experiences and uses it most beautifully as material.
I think her novels kind of go on a bit of a journey. So the first few novels very much draw on her own experience. I mean, one of my favourites of hers is a book called Offshore, which is all set on the houseboats in Battersea. And she lived on a houseboat herself, which, tragically sank. There's another brilliant one called At Freddy's, which is about a stage school where she taught at a stage school for a bit. So she draws on the end. There's The Bookshop, which was made into a film. So,
Yes.
there's these things that draw on her own experience. And then she, with I think The Beginning of Spring is possibly the first one that did this, she kind of leaps into these other worlds of Russia. There's The Blue Flower, and The Gate of Angels as well is really good, about Cambridge and the discovery of, I think it's just the discovery of the atom, if I remember correctly. But she starts with what she knows, and then she decides to get to know the rest of the world in the same way, and it's absolutely brilliant.
Yes, and you haven't mentioned one which I loved and read quite
Oh
recently,
yeah.
Human Voices, about her
Oh yeah.
experience at the BBC
That's
during the war.
I'm so glad you reminded me of that one, because so when I first read Penelope Fitzgerald several years ago, the first one I read of hers was Offshore, and it was so good. I felt this panic that I was going to run out of her books, because she hasn't written very many. I mean, I think it's sort of eight or nine, and then not that long. And I just thought, this is probably the best writer I'm ever going to come across. How, what am I going to do? So I sort of rationed them out. So I don't allow myself more than one a year. And Human Voices is the one that I still haven't quite got to.
Ah,
So what a treat
you've got
in
that to look
store.
forward to. Yes, that's wonderful. And she was appreciated when she was published. I mean, there's some wonderful reviews. My copy has got this plug on the back from Jan Morris, again a very distinguished writer, calling her one of the most skillful and fascinating novels I've read for years. And you've got Anita Bruckner saying Fitzgerald has mastered a city, a landscape, and a vanished time. She's written something remarkable, part novel, part evocation, and has done so in prose that never puts a foot wrong, which, I agree. So she's absolutely lauded by some of the, top writers of her generation.
Absolutely. And I think that there's this feeling among a lot of her review was for most of her books, is this: how does she do it?
Yes.
How has she created this world so in such a detailed, such a clever way? How did she get all that information about the number of samovars needed in Moscow at that time.
Yes.
And I think the answer is she really researched and researched and researched, but everyone is just so impressed
Yes.
at how and how she wears it so kind of lightly. It doesn't feel
That's the
heavy-handed.
thing. It doesn't, it's very often in, again, less experienced hands, people tend to sort of show off their research, and she doesn't. It's just in the background there.
Yes.
Interesting. You said a moment ago you thought this evocation of Moscow 1913 was, you're just there. And I agree. I read it and I felt cold. I could sort of, I wanted to sort of huddle into a coat until the end when, when spring is coming. But I found myself wondering, actually, how literally we're supposed to read it. Is the point that we feel as if we're there, or is it about something else? And I'm still not sure I've got a satisfactory answer to that. I have no way of judging. Was Moscow in 1913 really like that, or does it not even matter? I wonder if it's the wrong question to be asking about the book.
I think that's a really interesting thought. I mean, so for me, a thing about really great books is that they both capture a very specific time and place really well, so that you do imagine yourself there. But somehow through that specificity, they reach something quite universal. And I think not that many people manage to do it, but when they do it, it's so good.
Yes.
And somehow you're both in Moscow at that time, but you're connecting to these big questions and these sort of bigger things. I mean, to me, so much of about it is to do with this funny link between revolution and revelation. When something is suddenly revealed, how that spins everything that comes before it, and you suddenly everything's turned somehow upside down. And of course, revolution was coming to Russia then, and you get these glimpses of it. But yeah, the power of revelation and how that makes you question everything that's come before you and feel so uncertain is certainly something that's bigger than
Yes.
Moscow 1913.
And I think it's fascinating that the main character, Frank, he's both an insider and an outsider, because he's British, but he's lived there. He's lived there all his life, really, and obviously speaks the language and so on. So he's slightly sometimes on the surface of things, but equally he's completely embedded in the fabric of the city. It's that both that sort of tension between really belonging and not quite belonging that I think is very one of
Yeah,
the interesting things.
absolutely. And I mean, I suppose that feels very relevant to today's situation, where we're a much more migratory society, really. I mean, if where I am at the moment, London, this is something like 40% of Londoners were born there. There's over half weren't. It's some kind of crazy statistic like that. So what makes you a Londoner? What makes you of a place? How long do you need to live there? Are you ever, if you weren't born there, are you ever truly of a place? When does that switch come? I think Frank's situation will probably really ring true to a lot of readers who feel both of a place and not of it, not quite sure where they are.
And it's one of the questions about why Nellie leaves, isn't it? Has she gone?
Yes.
We don't. I don't think it's, again, I don't think it's a spoiler to say we never quite get to the bottom of that. But is it just that it's so different from, her life in London, or that's a bit mysterious, I think.
Yes, and there are some little flashes back near the beginning where you sort of can see where Frank and Nellie met in England, and I don't know, it feels kind of slightly awful. You see why she might want to leave that environment and go to Moscow and have
Yes.
that adventure.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk a bit about the characters. Did you have any favorites? As you say, she had
Oh God,
wonderful
so many.
eccentric characters. So tell me about some of the ones that you loved.
Okay, well, I think we have to have a particular fondness for Selwyn Crane, who at some point is described as not quite sane looking, which is just like, what a brilliant description. And he goes around wearing this kind of peasant smock shirt to he's a huge follower of Tolstoy, and I think doesn't he make his own sandals from birchwood and walks? He's a real eccentric, but I mean, he is kind of key to the big revelation. So again, there's that feeling you haven't quite got to the bottom of him. And one thing that I really like about Fitzgerald's writing is she almost always includes children in her cast. And I wonder why she does that. I mean, perhaps it's this feeling of it being quite unnerving as an adult coming into that point of view of not knowing where you are, not really knowing what's going on. But they also have surprising wisdom, you know. So one of her children here, Dolly, she's 13, and she, you know, at the beginning, Frank doesn't really know why Nellie's gone. And Dolly's the one who says things like, you know, I think you asked too much of her. And the mistake she probably made was getting married in the first place. You know, these quite adult comments, which seem to have more insight than Frank has. But yet she's totally lost when she's in the birch trees and sees these hands. So I'm very fond of her children as well as her eccentric adults.
Yes, no, I agree. I think the children are beautifully done, and there are other little, I think you say, you know, cameo roles. So there's a wonderful bit that you mentioned, Miss Kinsman,
Oh
Dowdy, another of the words that couldn't be translated into Russian,
yes,
and again,
but so surprising. And then she, you know, you think she's going to be a bit of a dud, but she doggedly pursues Frank through these rough streets of Moscow, and when it doesn't quite let him get off the hitch, corners him by the river and confronts him. And you should say, wow, good on you, Miss Kinsman. I didn't know that was coming. So yeah, these people who aren't what they seem, who you can't quite pigeonhole, and who I think you really embrace for their waywardness, really, their
And also the way she conjures them with a few brush strokes. Another one I loved was the chaplain, the English chaplain's wife. And there's a wonderful description. She was a scholar's daughter, brought up in Cambridge and not reconciled to living in Moscow. Although she hadn't, Frank knew, attended college herself, she might be called a student of a kind, a student of trouble, or rather of other people's troubles.
Oh, it's very good, isn't it?
I just know her, you know, there's that
Yes, yeah, you
part, yes.
completely know her. And I think the ones you don't know, you wish you did know. You know, I would love to know Selwyn Crane. I would want him to pop round for an eccentric dinner occasionally. And he has this another thing about Selwyn is there's a moment where I think it's Dolly sort of shows up at his apartment and demands tea. And of course he doesn't have tea. He says, oh, I only give the nine herbs of healing or something, and then lists this sort of strange infusion that he's going to give them. It's very brilliant.
So we've said there's lots of ambiguity in the novel, lots of an ambiguity about the choices people make, I think it would be fair to say. And to me, I was thinking about it. It's a bit like part of what you see. It's as if you're looking through a fog or a snowstorm somehow.
Yeah, it's very strange, isn't it? Because it's that combination of ambiguity and precision. You know, she has such an eye for the detail, and you know, these small little things that she gets absolutely precisely right. But alongside that, and kind of mixed with that, is this fogginess, as you say, this kind of strange filter. You don't really know what's going on.
Yes, and you mentioned in your introductory piece, you say you've got an absolute favourite passage of that I'd love you to just to read, Emily. It's so this is as at the end of the book, as spring is emerging.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so happy to read it. And it's really when I first read this book, which was several years ago, it's a passage that has stuck with me over the years, and yeah, it's marked in my book. It's one I often turn to when I'm trying to remember, you know, exactly how brilliant it was. I'll read it out, but before I do, I think just to say that it is right at the end of the book, and I suddenly thought about it this time as it being such a brilliant metaphor for what's been going on, how as a reader you think one thing's going on, you're very caught up in this particular story, and then this revelation kind of blows in like the spring wind, and everything kind of opens up, and you can suddenly hear all this other stuff that's been going on, and it you see everything that's come before very differently. And I think that could be what she's getting at with this passage about the window. Okay. All morning, the yardman had been removing the putty from the inner glass, piece by piece, flake by flake. Blashill, that's the dog, frantic at his long disappearance, howled at intervals, but the yardman worked slowly. When all the putty was off, without a scratch from the chisel, he called, lord of the moment, for the scrapings to be brushed away. The space between the outer and inner windows was black with dead flies. They too must be removed and the sills washed down with soft soap. Then, with a shout from the triumphant shoe-cleaning boy at the top of the house to Ben, still in the hall, the outer windows, some terribly stuck, were shaken and rattled till they opened wide. Throughout the winter, the house had been deaf, turned inwards, able to listen only to itself. Now the sounds of Moscow broke in, the bells and voices, the cabs and taxis which had gone by all winter unheard, like ghosts of themselves. And with the noise came the spring wind, fresher than it felt in the street, blowing in uninterrupted from the northern regions where the frost still lay. That's so good.
Thank
How did she
you.
Do it?
It's
How
wonderful.
Did she do it?
It's wonderful. Yeah. And yes, with that in mind, the Sunday Times reviewer at the time called it flawless and said it was packed with the kind of offbeat humour and perceptive observation that makes you turn back and read it again. And I know that you said in your piece, this is a book you read regularly. And can you sum up what is it that keeps you coming back?
I think it's the delight in how beautifully she writes. I mean, hopefully you got a feeling just from that passage. This is just such finely turned prose. It's sort of sparse and elegant. It's evocative. It's detailed and yet ambiguous. So it really does feel like a pleasure to be in that text. I think it's also, for me, when spring comes around, I am so in need of it. You know, winter feels long and cruel and you're desperate for that spring wind to come in. And I do think it's worth, well, I always find it kind of quite, what's the word, sort of, quite good for me to remind myself that actually there are places in the world where spring is even more wanted, where it's even colder, you know, where the windows are literally sealed up to keep the house warm. So it makes me think, you know, it's our winter here hasn't been quite as bad as that winter there. But also I think just that ending of openness and optimism and being receptive to what's going on outside is such a positive way to end a book and such a great feeling to have.
That's beautifully, beautifully summed up. Thank you. We've been discussing The Beginning of Spring by Penelope Fitzgerald, and you can read Emily's introductory essay and some questions for discussion in groups in the Church Times and online. And Emily, before you go, I always ask our guests to recommend something they have recently read and enjoyed that they think our readers might also enjoy. Have you got a title in mind for us?
Yes, I was actually thinking of books that might sit nicely alongside this Penelope Fitzgerald book. And the book that came to mind was called The True Deceiver by Tove Jansson. It's a really cold book. it's another book that you want to put your coat on. And it's another book where there's sort of unnerving things going on underneath the surface. She's probably best known for being the creator of the Moomins.
Moomins, indeed.
But she wrote these incredible adult books as well that are so kind of chilling and beautifully observed. I mean, really of a similar vibe in some ways to Penelope Fitzgerald. So yeah, I'd really recommend that, The True Deceiver.
So is that, that's a novel, is it? Because
I've
read her
exactly,
memoirs.
It's a novel.
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah, she wrote The Summer Book, which is a novel, but I think kind of based on her life and this island. The True Deceiver is a novel. Exactly. It's about a complex power play between these two women in this very, very cold place.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. It sounds like one to look forward to. Emily, thank you very much. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on, Sarah.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Church Times podcast. You can find more news, analysis, comment, and book reviews on our website, churchtimes.co.uk. If you are not yet a subscriber to the Church Times, you can try your first 10 issues for just £10. You'll get the paper delivered to your door every Friday, plus full access to our website and digital archive. Go to churchtimes.co.uk/subscribe to find out more.